information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
We care.
Here to border
it shows.
The law?
The country.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
This is the new year. Yes, it is, my friends. Welcome to another year of MediaMonarchy.com. Since September 11th, 2005, the website. Since October 27th, 2006, the radio show. So welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another year of MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 2nd, 2009. This is episode 105. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. This week, the Connell crash and Israeli attacks. We've got Obama, Biden, Zbig, and Huntington and the clash of civilizations, U.S. bases, recession races, 9/11 myths, toxic Tennessee, and if we have time, there'll be police brutality and the ambient noise of tyranny. It's a new year. We'll meet the new boss. It's January 2nd, 2009, episode 105 of MediaMonarchy.com. hands down, the best band named after an assassinated Archduke. That's brand new music from Franz Ferdinand from their forthcoming record tonight, Franz Ferdinand. That's called Lucid Dreams. And, of course, Archduke Franz Ferdinand's assassination was one of the precipitating events of World War I. And we're going to mention the other precipitating event in just a little bit. However, yet again, ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome you to episode 105 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 2nd, 2009. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster, coming to you live every Friday morning from the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network, praradio.org and revereradio.net, the worldwide home of free speech. Like I said, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and also thanks to the fine folks at 93.9 KBFR in Boulder, Colorado. You can, of course, make contact on FaceSpace, YouTube, Yahoo, IM, all with Media Monarchy as your keyword. And, of course, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org for the podcasts. So I kind of butchered that Death Cab for Cutie line, so this is the new year, but you get the idea. Do you feel any different? We'll see. There's so much to go over, and of course I had to take a little bit of time off for the holidays. Even a monarchy deserves a little bit of a holiday break. So it'll be a miracle if we can get through all the wonderful, horrible news I have lined up for you here on MediaMonarchy.com. The first thing I want to hit, however, is a thanks and a little bit of horn tooting of my own on my man Clyde Lewis's recent episode of the Ground Zero Lounge called Panopticon, the Pandemonium Configuration, where he talks about the arrival of digital TV, where you have to purchase a box that will tune you into another realm of propaganda. So now you'll, of course, remember that Clyde Lewis was on episode 100 of MediaMonarchy.com with an amazing two-hour interview. So here's my man Clyde giving Media Monarchy a great plug at the Ground Zero Lounge.
I tell you another place you need to go to, and I don't give plugs from any sites, but this site I have to give plugs to. That's MediaMonarchy.com. I did an interview on that radio show, and every time I go to that website, it's information you can't get anywhere else. MediaMonarchy.com. It's a great place to listen and also read, and without links to my site, I just got to remind people when they go out there, when they listen to my shows, because he puts my shows up there, you know, even when they're not even relevant. You know, I can probably talk about circus clowns, and he put it up. It's pretty awesome. So, MediaMonarchy.com.
It's it's always relevant, Clyde, even if it would be about circus clowns. But fortunately, it's not, and that's my man Clyde Lewis at Ground Zero Lounge. We're going to hit up my New Year's clearinghouse with the last little things, bad news that we scraped up and put together for you on MediaMonarchy.com. So, of course, end of the world, end of the year, what's the difference? From Global Research, quick note, an end of the year essay of sorts is in order, especially so given the bumpy ride capitalism has bestowed on us in this previous 12 months, and the portents for 2009 look to be even worse as capitalism, desperate to shed overvalued assets, descends into the abyss. Look at it this way. After the crash of 29 and the launch of the New Deal, it took some 6 years to engineer the outbreak of World War II, the surefire way of literally burning up surplus capital in awesome quantities. And if history has any lessons for us, some equivalent global conflagration is now in order. However, is this possible under the new circumstances, and over what time scale can such a capitalist catastrophe be engineered? Going along with the end of the world as we know it, posted up one of my favorite songs from one of my favorite bands, Super Furry Animals. It's not the end of the world. We're not going to listen to that, though, but it's there for you. There's also a handy-dandy chronology of major world events in 2008, Part 1 and Part 2 from the DPA, Deutsche Press Agentur, by way of monstersandcritics.com. Some of the last things are just headlines that I don't have time to explore, but the links are there for you. And these few other little last-minute 2008 downers, such as sewage and drinking water mingle in Texas. And, of course, we've noted all the yummy, yummy chemicals in the water all around. But that's from the Dallas Morning News. Sewage and drinking water mingle in Texas. Automatic speed limiting devices should be fitted to cars. That's out of the UK from the Telegraph. Nobody frightens children like the TSA. That's an op-ed over on the Examiner about how a reporter watched his 3-year-old son be harassed by the TSA into tears and to finally just say that those people scare me. We've, of course, noted before that U.S. and Japanese, what I would call bioterrorists, are, of course, recreating the deadly 1918 flu that we'll see if it'll accidentally get released from a bio lab in a drill. Nixon, Kissinger celebrated the 1972 bombing of North Vietnam. New papers declassified reveal. And you'll recall a couple weeks ago we hit up some of the new tape releases and things from good old Tricky Dick, which actually, there's nothing posted about this, but I have to mention this now that I thought of it. Late last night, I was watching a little-known Robert Altman film from 1984 called Secret Honor. It's a one-man show adapted, of course, from a stage play, starring Philip Baker Hall as Richard Nixon, and it's this two-hour, one-man show of Richard Nixon pacing around in a room, raving, and basically making recordings, and there's lots of cameras set up and tape recorders and things. It's fascinating just theatrically enough to watch Philip Baker Hall go nuts for 2 hours. However, there's a certain part where he starts to talk about he was basically a tool for the Committee of 100 and the Bohemian Grove, and he did their bidding, like keeping the war in Central Asia going on because it was all about drugs. So I absolutely recommend checking out Secret Honor by Robert Altman. I'm sure you can probably Netflix it, but I grabbed it from the fantastic Portland Public Library. More on, of course, it's all related, Henry Kissinger, Eminence Noir, that's from Consortium News, as well as LBJ's Treason Tapes. So all those bastards from the 70s, they all have new albums out. Did Poppy Bush kill Kennedy and frame Nixon? Of course, that question's been popped up here and again, and of course, you should always check out JFK 2, The Bush Connection, the documentary by John Hankey. And now we jump to the sinking of the Lusitania. This would be the other precipitating event of World War I. New proof of lies and deception by the U.S. and the U.K., and the sinking of the Lusitania. This comes by way of 911blogger.com, but I believe it originates from UK press. However, what we basically now know is that Germany was right, actually, and the Lusitania did have weapons on it. So if you recall, the Lusitania was sailing around, and Germans basically knew, hey, you guys are shipping weapons in disguise, and if you keep doing it, we're going to blow it up. And we were, and they did, and new divers have found weapons. One from the Washington Times, Holocaust love story, a fabrication. Another case of a made-up hoax story to sell a book, this time concerning a long-time, lifelong Holocaust love affair. Ex-Army employee pleads guilty to acting as an Israeli agent. That is the press release from our own Department of Justice. USDOJ.gov for you. The Centers for Disease Control is coming to Ashland, Oregon, because we're not taking enough of our shots. So, there are two other cities. I don't recall them off the top of my head, but Ashland, Oregon is one of them. The CDC are coming to see why people aren't taking their yummy vaccinations filled with thimerosal. So, we should welcome them when they get here. Defense contractors see big, big, big money in cybersecurity. That's from Threat Level. A couple about the police state in New York City, New Year's Eve. New Year's Eve security enhanced in New York City. That's one of the original reports from mensnewsdaily.com. However, Kurt Nimmo breaks it down a little better. National Guard soldiers to usher in New Year at Times Square. U.S. stocks suffer worst year since Great Depression. We've said it before, and we'll say it again in this very episode. That's from the elite mouthpiece, Financial Times of London. I'm not sure how this has shaken out. Blackout looms in the Time Warner Viacom fight, so they're battling about who pays what to carry channels. And, of course, this may heat up as we, of course, switch into the old digital conversion box coming soon. The Panopticon. Clyde Lewis sent me this link about blackout looms in Time Warner Viacom fight from the Associated Press. Kathy Griffin, if you'll note, sometime last year was in trouble. Forget what award show it was, but she basically said, "Suck it, Jesus. You didn't help me win this award." She was co-hosting some CNN New Year's Eve shindig with our favorite Anderson Cooper, elite, family, Yale-educated, slick media fox. So she's co-hosting that on New Year's Eve, and she basically yells at hecklers and says, "Hey, I don't come to your job and knock the dicks out of your mouth." So if you'd like to hear her say that, that link is there for you. A two-parter year in review from Tom Tomorrow and his fantastic cartoon, This Modern World. Part one, goodbye to all that. And part two, the end of an error. And finally, in the New Year's Eve clearinghouse, 2008, the year the U.S. media lost relevance. And that's from worldtribune.com. Let's get in now to the more important and pressing stories. Key witness in Ohio election fraud. Actually, I'm not going to say that yet. There's a guy named Michael Connell. He was implicated in rigging George Bush's 2000 and 2004 elections. So I realize I'm going to not play a trick on you, but let's listen. From July 24th, this is, I believe, on Democracy Now!, the great writer Mark Crispin Miller is talking about Mike Connell and his connection to election fraud.
Mike Connell has been named as Karl Rove's computer guru since 2000. The lawyers in the case refer to Connell as a high IQ Forrest Gump because he's been on the scene of every dubious election we've had over the last 8 years, starting with Florida 2000. Now, he's been named by a man named Stephen Spoonamore, S-P-O-O-N-A-M-O-R-E, who's a very unusual and particularly unimpeachable kind of whistleblower. He's a conservative Republican. He's a former McCain supporter. But above all, he is a renowned and highly successful expert at the detection of computer fraud. He works with big banks, he works for foreign governments, the Secret Service. His job is to figure out how computers are used to steal money or information or votes. Well, he's named a lot of people in the Bush-Cheney election subversion conspiracy. He's worked with them. He knows them personally. And months ago, he named Mike Connell and his company GovTech Solutions as having played a crucial role in the electronic subversion of the vote in Ohio in 2004, and Spoonamore has actually described the computer architecture that was used to do this. Now, on the strength of this testimony, the lawyers in the case had the judge issue a subpoena to Mike Connell last week. Connell defied the subpoena. He was in contempt. Late last week, the lawyers filed a motion to compel compliance. And to everyone's surprise and delight, the judge ordered Connell to appear today and to be deposed for 2 hours about his role in this long-standing electronic plot, basically, to flip votes towards the Republicans.
That's Mark Crispin Miller speaking about Mike Connell and his implications in vote fraud. So that was July 24th, 2008. Let's now move to December 22nd, 2008. Key witness in Ohio election fraud dies in a plane crash. This from velvetrevolution.us. Michael Connell, C-O-N-N-E-L-L. Michael Connell, the Bush IT expert who has been directly implicated in the rigging of George Bush's 2000 and 2004 elections, was killed December 19th, when his single-engine plane crashed 3 miles short of the Akron airport. Velvet Revolution, a nonprofit that has been investigating Mr. Connell's activities for the past few years, can now reveal that a person close to Mr. Connell has recently been discussing with a Velvet Revolution investigator how he can tell all about his work for George Bush. Mr. Connell told a close associate that he was afraid that Bush and Cheney would, quote, throw him under the bus. A tipster close to the McCain campaign disclosed to Velvet Revolution in July that McConnell's life was in jeopardy and that Karl Rove had threatened him and his wife, Heather. VR's attorney, Cliff Arnbeck, notified the United States Attorney General, Ohio law enforcement, and the federal court about these threats and insisted that Mr. Connell be placed in protective custody. VR also told a close associate of Mr. Connell not to fly his plane because of another tip that the plane could be sabotaged. Mr. Connell, a very experienced pilot, has had to abandon at least 2 flights in the past 2 months because of suspicious problems with his plane. On December 18th, Mr. Connell flew to a small airport outside of Washington, D.C. to meet some people. It was on his return flight the next day, December 19th, that he crashed. There's more from Raw Story, as well as 19 Action News. So we heard the old clip. Now let's get the new clip. Killed pilot accused of rigging the vote for the GOP.
45-year-old Michael Connell, an experienced pilot, crashed into a vacant house. Well, tonight, more about Connell and his ties to a possible White House scandal. 19 Action News reporter Blake Chenault with more at 11.
This is where Michael Connell worked, and it was from this building that he provided services to President Bush. An investigation is ongoing to find out exactly what kind of services Connell from this building provided to the president.
The fatal plane crash of Michael Connell was certainly untimely. The 45-year-old local man was accused of rigging the 2004 election for President Bush, a claim that Connell denied under oath. But under closer examination, civil attorney Clifford Arnbeck wanted Connell placed under federal protection. Arnbeck was worried that if Connell told all that he knew about President Bush and the 2004 campaign, Connell's life would be in jeopardy. Arnbeck said he received confidential information that Republican operative Karl Rove threatened Connell and his wife if Connell told all that he knew.
So who exactly is Michael Connell? Well, he worked here as a Republican computer specialist and consultant. Basically, he's accused of taking votes in 2004 from then-candidate John Kerry and diverting them to President Bush throughout the state of Ohio. But last month, under oath in a federal court, Connell denied having any knowledge of manipulating votes.
Records show the Bush campaign paid Connell's business some $800,000 in 2004, but it's unclear for what. Connell, though, was apparently told by a close friend not to fly his plane because the plane might be sabotaged. And twice in the last 2 months, Connell, who was an experienced pilot, canceled 2 flights because of suspicious problems with his plane. And now, last night, he had another problem with his plane, but this one took his life.
It is too early to tell if the federal investigation into the cause of Connell's death has any kind of tie to the work he provided from this office to the president. In Richfield, Lake Chenault, 19 Action News.
3 updates from Brad Blog, Raw Story, and Wayne Madsen. First, from Wayne Madsen Report, Connell was warned not to fly before a plane crash. Wayne Madsen Report has learned from knowledgeable sources in Ohio that Republican Party computer network guru Mike Connell was warned not to fly, and anonymous warnings conveyed to principals in the ongoing federal lawsuit of King Lincoln Bronzeville Neighborhood Association v. Blackwell, stemming from GOP-engineered vote fraud in the 2004 Ohio election, as well as a potential Ohio racketeer-influenced criminal organization, RICO standards, criminal proceeding against former Bush White House aide Karl Rove and Blackwell in the conspiracy to illegally steer Ohio's 20 electoral votes to the Bush column in 2004. Next from Raw Story, was Connell crash an accident or murder? The death of Republican IT guru Mike Connell last Friday in a fiery plane crash has been the subject of intense speculation online about whether it might have been murder, but very little of that speculation has made it into the national media. Now, one local TV station in Connell's home state of Ohio is acknowledging that there are questions about his death. We just heard that clip from Scott Taylor and 19 Action News in Cleveland. We also even hear, which I don't think we heard in the clip, Well, this sounds like a made-up story. One man rigging state elections to help his boss, President George Bush. After it's done, power players in Washington say get rid of the guy. Do I believe it? No. For now. Ryan Taylor, or rather Scott Taylor, noted that, quote, bad weather could have played a part in the crash, but some in Washington have a different opinion. Finally, from bradblog.com, there's a video of raw eyewitness footage of burning wreckage at Mike Connell's crash. There's no audio for me to play for you, but it's about a 10-minute video. And bradblog.com notes, I'm not sure what, if any, light this video, as shot by local eye and ear witness in Akron, Ohio, sheds on the plane crash and death of high-ranking GOP IT operative Mike Connell, but as it may reveal something to somebody in the still unexplained and surprisingly timed crash, I suppose it may be useful to put it here on the record. And so we have Mike Connell, Republican, electronic vote fraud, dead in a plane crash. Was he well stoned? I'm pretty sure he was. We'll get all the updates on that as they, I'm sure, spill out. The other massive story of numerous, but this is the one, and this is the one you'll notice our favorite change agent won't say a goddamn thing about, and the current resident of the White House won't say a goddamn thing about. Israeli airstrikes in Gaza leave hundreds and hundreds and hundreds dead. So initially, when I posted this up Saturday, December 27th, it was Israel kills 208 in air assault on Gaza Strip. I do have more updates in this story. However, I've almost lost track, and I've almost lost patience with it all. But let's get the initial report from Reuters, Saturday, December 27th. Israeli warplanes and helicopters pounded the Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip on Saturday, killing at least 205 people in the bloodiest one-day death toll in the 60 years of conflict with the Palestinians. Militants in the Gaza Strip, who have launched dozens of rocket attacks against Israel since a truce expired just over a week ago, fired more salvos that killed one Israeli man and wounded several others. Both sides said they were ready to stage wider assaults, threatening to plunge the region into a crisis that could leave stalled talks over Palestinian statehood in tatters.
Under attack, Israel's Air Force unleashes devastation on the Gaza Strip. On the ground in one of the world's most densely populated areas, it's a gruesome scene. This Palestinian policeman prepares for his end. These human targets were no match for the high explosion munitions that hit them. This building was among the targets, and as the victims are discovered and carried off to hospitals, the attacks just keep coming. The people of Gaza have been bracing themselves for this ever since the six-month ceasefire with Israel expired last week. Emergency medical officials in Gaza estimate that as many as 155 have been killed, but it's just too early to tell. Wounded Palestinians stagger the streets in search of medical attention. But it was already sorely lacking from years of siege and embargo, which Israel and the international community imposed on the people of Gaza. Calls for unity have already sounded from the West Bank.
And we have to be unified to be finally free from this oppression and occupation and injustice that has continued longer than any people can tolerate.
In Syria, the Hamas leadership has vowed revenge. From Jordan, a neighboring country which has peace with Israel, an ominous condemnation.
I address the Arab rulers saying, he who is not supporting Gaza now is a traitor. The Arab people must now take the streets. We can no longer stand in silence. After we have seen rivers of blood running in Palestine, we should sacrifice our own for the Palestinian people. We demand the Arab rulers who dealt with the Jewish enemy as dear friends to revoke all their agreements, treaties, and promises with the criminal enemy. Whoever establishes a relation with the enemy is nothing but a criminal.
The so-called Mideast Quartet has yet to weigh in, but then again, they so far failed to protect the Palestinian population in any meaningful way. Clayton Swisher, Al Jazeera.
I have many disgusting updates as the carnage continued. Many of these thanks to blacklistednews.com. Just run down the list of lowlights and headlines. Palestine and Israel, the ring of terror tightens. Israel masses troops and tanks for possible ground invasion. The dangers of an India-Pakistan war. Egypt accused of deceiving Hamas. Iran orders all Muslims to defend Palestinians against Israeli Gaza raids. That's from Haaretz. Israeli airstrikes on Gaza Strip imperil Obama's peace chances. More on airstrikes. Airstrikes on Gaza. Hundreds wounded. Again, the same report. Iran orders Muslims to defend Palestinians. That's from Reuters in the UK. Always trying to pin some blame on Iran. Russia asked Israel to end Gaza attacks. I'm sure Russia is bad for doing that, too. Mosques hit, hundreds of targets, panic. Israel reinforces troops at border. Retaliatory air armada. Pelosi, of course, notes that the U.S. must stand strongly with Israel. She's in AIPAC's back pocket. Violent protests at Israeli embassy in London. In criminal escalation, Israeli occupation forces strike on Gaza, kill and injure over 900. There's one, I believe this is from Chris Floyd at Empire Burlesque. Shock, awe, and lies, the truth behind the Israeli attack on Gaza. However, as always, you'll hear the claim Israel has to defend itself, or it's all about one, you know, single death, supposedly. Israel planned this for months during their war games called Operation Cast Lead. I suppose it could be lead. I haven't heard it read out loud. Operation Cast Lead, CASTLEAD. They planned it for months. War games, terror drills. That's why we pay attention to those things. Now, I mentioned, of course, that our two misleaders haven't really said a word about any of this because, of course, Israel has the right to do whatever it wants. But from Kurt Nemo, he notes that Obama, no comment on Gaza slaughter, because Obama no longer has to placate pro-Israel voters, including no shortage of Christian Zionists. So his lack of comment on the premeditated slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza should send us a message. An Obama administration will continue the long-standing U.S. policy of allowing Israel to wantonly kill Palestinians and pay the Israeli government handsomely to do so. In 2008 alone, the U.S. gave $20.27 billion to Israel, more than a 12% increase in foreign aid from the previous year. In fact, it would seem Obama is dedicated to supporting Israel, no matter how many Palestinians it slaughters or starves. All of us are concerned about the impact of closed border crossings on Palestinian families. However, we have to understand why Israel is forced to do this, Obama wrote in a letter to Ambassador Khalilzad. Quote, Israel has the right to respond while seeking to minimize any impact on civilians. And our other misleader refuses to interrupt his final vacation as the Middle East crisis escalates. This from Think Progress. While Bush has been briefed on the situation by Condi and Hadley, he has opted not to interrupt his final vacation as president to make a public statement on the crisis. For someone who's enjoyed the most vacation days as a sitting president, including days spent relaxing in comfort during Hurricane Katrina and in the lead-up to 9/11, it shouldn't come as a huge surprise that Bush prioritizes vacationing over crisis management. There's finally one from Paul Joseph Watson, Israel accused of massive war crime atrocities. And there are, of course, comments from a man, Alex, in Germany. What dovetails with this, interestingly, former presidential candidate, former congresswoman, 9/11 truther, Cynthia McKinney. A boat carrying former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney was struck by an Israeli patrol boat, according to reports from witnesses and Israeli officials. CNN reports that their correspondent, Carl Penhall, was also aboard the 60-foot Gibraltar-registered pleasure boat Dignity when the contact occurred. In a radio message, the Israelis accused the vessel of being involved in terrorist activity.
Continuing our breaking news coverage of the crisis in the Middle East. And earlier this morning, we told you about a 66-foot pleasure boat, the Dignity, which had been trying to deliver medical supplies, urgently needed medical supplies, to Gaza City. That boat, while according to our CNN reporter Carl Penhall, who was on it at the time, was in international waters, was rammed by an Israeli patrol boat. And there you see the boat itself had to make way back to Tyre in Lebanon as it was taking on water. Also on board that craft was former Georgia Congresswoman, former presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney, and she joins us now via the internet from Tyre in Lebanon. And Congresswoman McKinney, can you tell us what happened? We had our Carl Penhall saying that you were in international waters, clearly in international waters, when accosted by the and confronted by these Israeli patrol boats.
Well, I wouldn't call it accosting. I would call it ramming. Let's just call it as it is. Our boat was rammed three times, twice in the front and one on the side. But let me also state for the record that what we experienced earlier today pales in comparison to what the people of Gaza are experiencing right now as we do this interview.
Right, but let me
our mission was a peaceful mission to deliver medical supplies. Well, and our mission was thwarted by the Israelis, the aggressiveness of the Israeli military. Now, one of the things that I would like to ask President-elect Obama is to say something, please, about the humanitarian crisis that is being experienced right now by the people of Gaza. I would like to ask my former colleagues in the United States Congress to stop sending weapons of mass destruction around the world, as we are about to celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Let us remember what he said. He said that the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence on the planet. And guess what? We experienced a little bit of that violence because the weapons that are being used by Israel are weapons that have been supplied
well,
Congresswoman by the United
McKinney,
States government.
Congresswoman McKinney, if I could you describe what happened? Was there any warning given by the Israeli patrol boats? We're hearing some reports out of Israel that they were trying to stop you from coming into Israeli waters and that the Dignity, the captain of the Dignity, tried to maneuver around the boat, and that's when the collision occurred.
As you can see, I'm standing beside a pleasure boat. What the Israelis are saying is outright disinformation. But I recall that there was another boat that was attacked by Israelis, and it was the USS Liberty. And people would like to forget about the USS Liberty, but I haven't forgotten about it, and the people who were on that ship have not forgotten about what happened to them. And what happened to us last night was a direct threat to our mission, but not our cause.
Former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, thanks for joining us this morning. We're glad that everybody came away from that incident relatively unscathed. I know it must have been a harrowing one, though. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
More amazing work from Cynthia McKinney. So she even mentions the lies and disinformation of Israel, like the USS Liberty. She also penned a little report about this. Oh, what a day from Cyprus to Gaza. And so this is written by Cynthia McKinney. I grabbed it from globalresearch.ca. I've called for President-elect Obama to say something. The Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip are seeing the worst violence in 60 years, and it's being reported. To date, President-elect Obama has remained silent. The Israelis are using weapons supplied to them by the U.S. government. Strict enforcement of U.S. law would require the cessation of all weapons transfers to Israel. Adherence to international law would require the same. As we're about to celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, let us remember that he said the United States is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, and that our lives begin to end the day we remain silent about things that matter. I implore the president-elect to not send Congress a budget that contains more weapons for Israel. We have so much more to offer. And I implore the Congress to vote no on any budget and appropriation bills that provide more weapons transfers, period. Israel is able to carry out these intense military maneuvers because taxpayers in the U.S. give their hard-earned money to our representatives in Congress, and our Congress chooses to spend that money in this way. Let's stop it and stop it now. There's been too much bloodshed, and while we still walk among the living, let us not remain silent about the things that matter. We really can promote peace and have it if we demand it of our leaders. That's from Cynthia McKinney, as her boat was rammed by the Israelis as they tried to deliver aid. Some dick posted a comment on this story, and it says, oh my God, Israel tried to assassinate... Oh no, I'm sorry, let me get the full essence. OMG, Israel tried to assassination Cynthia McKinney for exposing the truth about 9/11 being an inside job, as she remembered the inside job on the USS Liberty. The dumbass remarks always seem to be left anonymously. But let's move to two massive headers of the Police State International. The first one is biometrics, hazardous substances, and insurrection. First, from Federal Computer Weekly, FCW.com, the Department of Homeland Stupidity will expand their U.S. visit biometric collection. The Homeland Security Department will soon begin collecting digital fingerprints and photographs from lawful permanent residents of the United States and people seeking to enter the country on an immigration visa or as refugees. The biometric data will be collected from additional groups of those persons when they enter the U.S. starting January 18th. As part of DHS's U.S. Visitor and Immigrant Status Indicator Technology, VISIT. In a statement, Homeland Stupidity officials called the expansion a, quote, positive step forward in a process designed to further improve public safety and national security while ensuring the integrity of the immigration system. I won't say anything. Let's move to the next one. EPA veils hazardous substances. This from JSOnline.com. The United States Environmental Protection Agency routinely allows companies to keep new information about their chemicals secret, including compounds that have been shown to cause cancer and respiratory problems, the journal Sentinel has found, the newspaper where we get this from. They examined more than 2,000 filings in the EPA's Registry of Dangerous Chemicals for the past 3 years. In more than half the cases, the EPA agreed to keep the chemical name secret. In hundreds of other cases, it allowed the company filing the report to keep its name and address confidential. Sewage in the water in Texas. God knows what in the waters veiled by the EPA. But let's not forget our good friends at the FDA as well. This from naturalnews.com. FDA stuns scientists, declares mercury in fish to be safe for infants, children, and expectant mothers. In a truly astonishing betrayal of public safety, even for the FDA, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration revoked its warning about mercury in fish, saying that eating mercury-contaminated fish no longer poses any health threat to children, pregnant women, nursing mothers, and infants. Last week, the FDA declared trace levels of melamine to be safe in infant formula. A few weeks earlier, it said the plastics chemical bisphenol A was safe for infants to drink. Now it says children can eat mercury too. Is there any toxic substance in the food that the FDA thinks might be dangerous? Aspartame, MSG, sodium nitrate, mercury. This FDA decision on mercury in fish has alarmed EPA scientists, who called it scientifically flawed and inadequate, reports the Washington Post, with the link for you. So they can't say that mercury in fish is bad while they try and tell you that mercury and thimerosal in the shots are good for you, and your fillings are good for you. If we move to news-wise, smart surveillance system may tag suspicious or lost people. Engineers here are developing a computerized surveillance system that, when completed, will attempt to recognize whether a person on the street is acting suspiciously or appears to be lost. Intelligent video cameras, large video screens, and geo-referencing software are among the technologies that will soon be available to law enforcement and security agencies. In the recent proceedings of the 2008 IEEE Conference on Advanced Video and Signal-Based Surveillance, with a link for you to that website, James W. Davis and doctoral student Karthik report that they've completed the first three phases of the project. Here we go. They have one software algorithm that creates a wide-angle video panorama of a street scene, another that maps the panorama onto a high-res aerial image of the scene, and a method for actively tracking a selected target. So that's basically the press release from the school and organizations that's working on smart surveillance systems. Are you suspicious? Or are you just lost? God help you if you're both. One from Daily Dose of Terror, Homeland Security, arming flights, as well as some cyber war games. However, if we move to Raw Story, and of course, the Fort Dix 6. Entrapment? 5 out of 6 of the Fort Dix 6 plot have been convicted. 5 men whom attorneys said paid FBI informants prodded them into exploring their deepest fantasies about waging jihad on America were convicted in a federal court last Monday of conspiring to kill U.S. soldiers, but acquitted on attempted murder charges. The men allegedly planned to attack Fort Dix in New Jersey, although defense lawyers argued that they never intended to carry out the plot and were drawn into making incriminating statements by the informants, one of whom was an illegal immigrant on probation for bank fraud, and another who was paid $150,000 to secretly record the men. The verdict was met with intense skepticism in the Muslim community, to say the very least. And that's from Newsday.com. And of course, the flashback link's in there, and you can read all about another phony terror plot. Another note about the new Homeland Security USA reality show. More is coming out about that, so that's a headline from the Associated Press. Homeland Stupidity turns reality TV star on ABC, which, of course, we noted that 8 months ago and just a few weeks ago for you. So we're excited about that one. One from Danger Room, and it was too ridiculous and funny not to post up. Air Force new metal band will rock your face off. Somebody drop a satellite-guided bomb on my head. I'm not sure if I can take another note of Max Impact, the Air Force's official new metal band, or their press releases, which were clearly written by a member of the Onion's editorial staff. By the way, Max Impact is one of 7 official Air Force musical ensembles, and that doesn't count Tops in Blue, the service's singin', swingin', family-friendly Vegas-style review. You must see the photo of Max Impact. The dude is playing. He's singing, and he still has his uniform on. And it's ridiculous. On a much more serious note, it was posted up anew. However, when I looked it up, it's actually a nice little flashback. Let's go way back to May 22nd, 2007. And here, what a guy named Ron Paul was talking about.
Some of the least noticed and least discussed changes in the law were the changes made to the Insurrection Act of 1807 and to Posse Comitatus by the Defense Authorization Act of 2007. These changes pose a threat to the survival of our republic by giving the president the power to declare martial law for as little reason as to restore public order. The 1807 Act severely restricted the president in his use of the military within the United States borders. And the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 strengthened these restrictions with strict oversight by Congress. The new law allows the president to circumvent the restrictions of both laws. The Insurrection Act has now become the, quote, Enforcement of the Laws to Restore Public Order Act, close quote. This is hardly a title that suggests that the authors cared about or understood the nature of a constitutional republic. Now, martial law can be declared not just for insurrection, but also for natural disasters, public health reasons, terrorist attacks or incidents, or for the vague reason called other conditions. The president can call up the National Guard without congressional approval or the governor's approval and even send these state guard troops into other states. The American Republic is in remnant status. The stage is set for our country eventually devolving into a military dictatorship, and few seem to care. These precedent-setting changes in the law are extremely dangerous and will change American jurisprudence forever if not revised. The beneficial results of our revolt against the king's abuses are about to be eliminated, and few members of Congress and few Americans are aware of the seriousness of the situation.
Ron Paul on martial law. That goes back to May 22nd, 2007. And I just recently saw the futuristic and forward-looking RonPaul2012.com. But now we're going to move into the second massive heading of Police State International. This was posted up last Sunday, December 28th, on MediaMonarchy.com. DHS, Triple W, Seaburn, and the breakup of U.S. First, again, from Federal Computer Weekly, FCW.com, Homeland Stupidity considers searching for blogs with terrorism clues. The Homeland Security Department might soon start searching the internet for blogs and message boards that terrorists are planning, or rather that terrorists are using to plan attacks in the United States, originally reported from USA Today. Researchers say terrorists are increasingly using the internet to plan operations and spread propaganda, according to a Department of Homeland Stupidity statement. The newspaper reports that the department is looking for companies that can help it find relevant information online. I wonder what those companies will be. Could that be FaceSpace? GooTube? Another one, government searching internet in near real time for terrorists. But if we jump to the Telegraph, websites could be given cinema-style age ratings. In an interview with the Daily Telegraph, telegraph.co.uk, Andy Burnham says he believes that new standards of decency need to be applied to the web. He's planning to negotiate with Obama's incoming American administration to draw up new international rules for English language websites. The cabinet minister, Andy Burnham, describes the internet as, quote, quite a dangerous place, end quote, and says he wants ISPs to offer parents child-safe web services. Won't someone please think of the children? Giving film-style ratings to individual websites is one of the options being considered. When asked directly whether age ratings could be introduced, Mr. Burnham replies, yes, that would be an option. This is an area that is really now coming into full focus. Internet 2, coming soon. DOD may act on U.S. civil unrest. That's from military.com. But from the Associated Press, Homeland Security forecasts 5 years of terror threats. The terrorism threat to the United States over the next 5 years will be driven by instability in the Middle East and Africa, persistent challenges to border security, and increasing internet savvy, says a new intelligent assessment obtained by the Associated Press. Chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear attacks are considered the most dangerous threats that could be carried out against the U.S. But those threats are also the most unlikely because it's so difficult for Al-Qaeda and similar groups to acquire the materials needed to carry out such plots, according to the internal Homeland Stupidity Threat Assessment for the years 2008 to 2013. Officials also predict that domestic terrorists in the forms of radical animal rights and environmental extremists will soon become more adept with explosives and increase their use of arson attacks. Thanks, Associated Press. The U.S. Army document that proves the U.S. is the world's number one sponsor of world terrorism. That's from Existentialist Cowboy. However, if we jump to, interestingly enough, Pravda. U.S. needs a nuclear explosion to turn the world into dictatorship. Again, this is coming out of Russia. This is from Pravda. Is the United States going to put dictatorship into effect under the guise of the anti-terror and economic fallout? So, the answer is that they need another 9/11 in the USA. Terrible and bloody events are in store for the world in the beginning of 2009. Most likely, the world will witness a reality show with a nuclear blast, which will be used as a reason for the U.S. administration to change the world order again and leave the new Great Depression behind. There is every reason to believe that the Russian Federation may suffer as a result of this possible initiative. Crazy conspiracy theories from Pravda. But if we jump to Future Storm, police in the U.S. could soon have pain ray guns, as if they don't already have some. Imagine a world where police have the ability to fire pain ray guns at protesters that instantly cause them excruciating pain as soon as they are activated. Imagine a world where police have the ability to torture from a distance anyone they want at the touch of a button. Does it sound like something out of a sci-fi novel? It isn't. It's in the final stages of development and could soon be a reality on the streets of America. NewScientist.com is reporting that the United States Department of Justice is developing two portable non-lethal weapons that inflict severe pain from a distance using either microwave technology or laser beams. Coming soon to a reality show on your streets near you. GeorgeWashington.blogspot.com asks the musical question that many are already asking. Will the U.S. break up? It's just a little piece I've pulled out for you here. The larger, more complex a system, the more likely it is to break down. Something like a simple pendulum with few moving parts could last many years, but very large, complicated things, like the Large Hadron Collider, break down much more quickly. America now has some 300 million people, 50 states, and more federal, state, and local agency than anyone can possibly list. It's hard to govern such a large, complex, and populous system when anything goes seriously wrong, and a lot is going wrong right now. The U.S. military agrees that the chance of a breakdown in the system is real. With a link to that report from Newsmax.com, and of course, we just had the military.com posting that they're ready to act in case of civil unrest for whatever reason it might be. Finally, on this second Police State International posting, a curious note: Greg Nixon, the awesome activist and blogger at dailydoseofterror.blogspot.com, seems to have hung up his skates for the time being. So there's a link to you for the last, at least at the moment, post from Daily Dose of Terror, where he basically, unfortunately, says, what's the fucking point of talking about all the fear and all the crazy terror? And he even notes the next article that we're going to go into about terror drills. He basically says, the terror 9/11 game is passé, and it's going to be economic warfare. But the aforementioned article is from Kurt Nemo and TruthNews.us. Northcom, our fine friends at Northcom, the ones who now, of course, have the combat troops here, they conducted a humanitarian support exercise in Maryland. The Armed Forces Press Service has initiated a propaganda campaign designed to convince the American people that the deploying of the 3rd Infantry Division in the United States in violation of the Posse Comitatus Act is a good thing. The propaganda piece appeared on the Hinesville, Georgia Coastal Courier's website on December 26th, with, of course, a link for you, saying, quote, "The first active-duty unit dedicated to supporting U.S. civilian authorities in the event of a nuclear, biological, or chemical attack recently wrapped up 3 days of intensive training. Its members hope they never have to apply in real life." That was said by Donna Miles as she reported for the Armed Forces Press Service. Continuing, soldiers from the 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade Combat Team got hands-on training and skills they would depend on to provide humanitarian support during a chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear or high-yield explosive incident known here as a Seaburn. In order to portray the military as humanitarian saviors, the Armed Forces Press Service included a photo of a soldier wielding the jaws of life during an exercise that included buddy teams recently returned from Iraq's Anbar province as they were removing mannequins from the rubble of a collapsed building. Many links in there for you to read about the violation of posse comitatus with the combat brigades here under NORTHCOM. But they'll stage these little PSYOP events where they look like they're Mr. Helpful. I'm officer friendly. Even though you're a fucking civilian and they have the authority under the unitary executive, which of course the co-presidency that's happening right now, you know that the new puppet that's going to come in here in about 18 days. Ooh, I can't wait. The co-Bush Obama regime that's going on right now, again, as we've noted, most people saying I've never seen anything like this, the coordination, the continuity, if you will. But from USA Today with my own headline, Bush Obama regimes to run transition terror drill in January. What would happen if terrorists attacked the United States at the start of Obama's presidency? The Bush administration doesn't want to wait to find out. It's planning to test the incoming government's readiness next month in a series of tabletop exercises involving top Bush and Obama officials. Concerned about the first handoff of a presidential power since 9/11, the White House is also preparing briefing books and office manuals designed to bring the incoming Obama administration up to speed in a hurry. This is the first wartime transition in 40 years, and it's probably the first transition in a couple of centuries in which our homeland itself has been under threat, said White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolton, who's supervising the effort. The goal is to, quote, make sure that those who are coming in are as well prepared as they can be to deal with an actual threat here in the country. There are a couple links in there to The Guardian, as well as MarketWatch.com. And I should note, now we're well into hour number two of episode 105 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 2nd, 2009. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. Kicking out live to you every Friday morning at 10 Pacific Time and 1 Eastern Time on the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network. Segueing nicely into the Obama saga. So let's actually reflect on that previous story for a moment before we careen forward. They're going to run terror drills. It sounds like the Bush administration is the red team as the bad guys, and Obama is the blue team. You get it? So we'll see what happens with the tabletop exercise. I recall there was a drill going on called Operation Nine Lives when Ronald Reagan happened to be shot. There always seems to be a Bush behind every assassination. But let's move to the Obama side heading, prosecution, continuity, eligibility, or the lack of all. First from Raw Story, Biden evades the question on possible prosecution of the Bush administration. Joe Biden would not directly answer a question about whether or not top-ranking members of the Bush administration should be prosecuted for abuse at prisons around the world. Interviewed by ABC News' George Stephanopoulos and, of course, former Clintonite operative, Biden said that he was, quote, not ruling it in and not ruling it out.
Well, I don't agree with the vice president.
It sounded like you were going to say you still stand by your characterization.
I think the recommendations, the advice that he has given to President Bush, and maybe advice the president already had decided on before he got it, I'm not making that judgment, has been not healthy for our foreign policy, not healthy for our national security, and it has not been consistent with our Constitution, in my view. His notion of a unitary executive, meaning that in time of war, essentially all power, goes to the executive, I think is dead wrong. I think it was mistaken. I think that it caused this administration, in adopting that notion, to overstep its constitutional bounds, but at a minimum, to weaken our standing in the world and weaken our security. I stand by that that judgment.
He says the more you learn about the threats as you see the intelligence, the more you're going to come around to the Bush administration's point of view on their counterterrorist policy.
I'll make two responses to that. One, as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, unless they were lying to me all along, I knew the detail of the threat. I was one of those four people that had access to all that information. One of those eight people that had access to that information. Secondly, I have been getting what they call that presidential briefing you get every morning from the intelligence community since the day we were elected, not sworn in. I have learned nothing thus far that would change my view. Nothing thus far that would change my fundamental view that Guantanamo should close, number one. That number two, the way in which we have conducted our policy in terms of both surveillance as well as the detainees has hurt our reputation around the world. And to quote from a previous national security report put out by the intelligence community, we have created, not dissuaded, more terrorists as a consequence of this policy. Nothing I've learned thus far has changed my fundamental view on the constitutional as well as the practical positions we should take relative to the issues of torture.
He sure can talk a good game. That's Biden. We've actually created more terrorists, which of course is true. But Obama will not prosecute Bush and Cheney. This from the Tehran Times. Mark my words, President Obama will follow in the footsteps of his predecessors by not holding his predecessor, George W. Bush, and members of his administration liable for violating the United States Constitution and criminally responsible for treason, 9/11, financial fraud, mass murder, and war crimes. So it was nice of the Tehran Times to, of course, include the crimes of 9/11 on the list of Bush-Cheney crimes. However, it's not just them. It's the fake, phony, left-right paradigm. Continuity we can believe in from Counterpunch. This is part mea culpa, so please indulge my quoting myself. Back on November 5th, much of the country celebrated the end of an era in the elections of the first non-white president. I wrote, we'll know soon enough how hard we'll have to fight bad Obama policy. Even before Inauguration Day, we'll know. Who Obama picks for his team will be all telling. If Obama fails to break completely with the narcissistic baby boomer politicians, we'll know. If he keeps Gates at defense or appoints Powell in his place, we'll know. Well, that sure was quick. From the AFP, Obama to tap retired admiral as intelligence czar. President-elect Barack Obama has tapped retired Navy Admiral Dennis Blair as his intelligence czar, U.S. media reported last Saturday. Unnamed government officials familiar with the selection process confirmed the choice to the L.A. Times. If confirmed as Director of National Intelligence, DNI, Blair would face ticking international time bombs inherited from the administration of President George W. Bush, including two wars, secret CIA prisons overseas, and domestic wiretapping. From the World Socialist website, Obama, the Military, and the Threat of Dictatorship, Bill Van Auken writes, with his choice of Admiral Dennis Blair as DNI, Obama has now named three recently retired four-star military officers to serve in his cabinet. This unprecedented representation of the senior officer corps within the incoming Democratic administration is indicative of a growth in the political power of the U.S. military that poses a serious threat to basic democratic rights. As head of the U.S. military specific command in 1999 through 2000, Dennis Blair was distinguished by his efforts to solidarize the Pentagon with the military of Indonesia as it carried out butchery in East Timor, effectively vetoing the half-hearted human rights concerns voiced by the Clinton administration. So, new DNI, of course, involved in military slaughter abroad. There's one on Obama's policies versus Richard Falk's policies on Israel and occupied Palestine. That's, again, of course, from globalresearch.ca. And we noted on the recent B-side, 104 of MediaMonarchy.com, how Richard Falk was recently expelled from Israel, immediately preceding their new wave of attacks. A good one from Op-Ed News. Explain to me again why we chose Obama instead of Ron Paul. Here is another piece written by Ron Paul. And of course, there's a link for you. And yet again, he's correct to infinite degree. He's a regular Nostradamus, as far as I'm concerned, predicting nearly every major catastrophe of the last 8 years and doing so years before they occurred. He predicted the Russian-Georgian conflict would be a possible consequence of our invasion in Iraq. Check. With a link. He predicted the housing collapse. Check. With a link. He predicted the implosion of the banking system clear back in the 90s. Check. Link. He predicted the Iraq war would be an endless quagmire and on and on and on. When no one listened and his clueless fellow Republicans had the nerve to laugh at him on stage, he still spoke the truth, and once again, he's been right all along. This time about the real agenda of Barack Obama and the mindless Democrats in Congress. More elite government, more spending, more inflation, less freedom, less prosperity, and a complete disregard for the voice of the people. Bailouts, anyone? We can all have our disagreements about his disdain for taxes and funding different government programs, but when it comes to monetary policy, Ron Paul has all but never been wrong. Again, that's an op-ed piece on opednews.com. Returning again to one of our favorite talking heads, who generally seems to do good work, and we'll hit the other one here in just a minute, but right now, Lou Dobbs, will the North American Union happen under Obama?
Well, another announcement today by President-elect Obama giving new life to the North American Union, a plan by business and political elites to tear down the trade barriers among the United States, Canada, and Mexico, and to create a NAFTA superhighway, all of which to be done without the approval of Congress or the American people. President-elect Obama named a diehard free trader and a NAFTA supporter to be his U.S. trade representative. Bill Tucker has our report.
Ron Kirk is President-elect Obama's pick to be his front man on trade. Kirk made his name in politics, serving as mayor of Dallas, where he was known as a staunch supporter of free trade agreements, NAFTA in particular. He was a big proponent of a trade corridor from Mexico up through Texas, a road he once referred to as a NAFTA freeway. His nomination was welcomed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers. Advocates for a change in trade policy are not so happy.
There's clearly been a gap between President-elect Obama's pledges to the American public to truly transform our failed trade policy and some of the very important economic appointments he's made who represent people who helped implement or at least support the failed status quo.
Congressman Phil Hare, a Democrat from Obama's home state of Illinois, issued a statement expressing his disappointment, saying, quote, "I have concerns about Mayor Kirk's vocal support for NAFTA and unfair trade with China. Mayor Kirk previously has said he wants to make Dallas the capital city of NAFTA. But for every Dallas, there are dozens of Galesburgs, a place President-elect Obama knows well. Maytag, the appliance maker, was once the largest employer in Galesburg, Illinois, until it moved 1,600 jobs to Mexico. Critics say the appointment falls in line with others by Obama, and they don't like what they see.
If you look at President Obama's economic team, they have all been enthusiastic supporters of outsourcing-focused trade policy agreements that have exported not only good jobs from American shores, but high-value, technology-intensive production.
Our current trading policies have created a neat $1 trillion deficit and have been blamed for the loss of millions of American jobs that have moved to low-wage countries.
Now, the apparent contradiction in Obama's words and actions has activists on another front worry. Last February, Obama pledged that he would resume the security and prosperity partnership talks between Mexico and Canada that President Bush initiated. He also said the talks will be transparent. Those opposed to the North American Union say that now, whether he will or will not deliver on that promise becomes something they doubt.
Well, this is this is early on. The president elect is starting to look like it's starting to look when it comes to trade, as Lori Wall, the Public Citizen, pointed out. Global Trade Watch. I mean, the old boss is starting to look a lot like the new boss when it comes to the issues of offshoring, free trade. This is troubling indeed.
It is, and all the people in the piece tonight, Luke, are people who are inclined to support him, who are people who want to be on his side, and they're reluctant in their sort of reservations about what he's doing with Kirk.
Well, it is an extraordinary appointment, but I'm sure that we'll find out some others were extraordinary too, just as we have in the previous presidencies.
A North American Union you can believe in. A quick cutting from an excellent and lengthy article from the infamous David Icke, Barack Obama, the Naked Emperor. I'm writing this in the last days of 2008 as I watch with dismay as vast numbers of people across the world, including many who should know better, have been duped by the mind game called Operation Obama. Even people with some understanding of the conspiracy have said things like, well, at least he's not Bush, and well, at least it's great to see such a new spirit of hope. No, he's not Bush. He's potentially far more dangerous. And what is the use of a spirit of hope if it's based on a lie? In fact, what use is hope at all? Obama's wife, Michelle, who I wouldn't trust to tell me the date in a calendar factory, said that everything begins and ends with hope. Utter nonsense. Hope is a meaningless emotion because its fruits are always in the future and by definition never in the now. Hope is like riding a carousel horse. No matter how fast you go, you never get closer to the one in front. The idea, however, is to persuade you to stay on the horse, despite the inevitable disappointment, in the hope that things will change, but they don't because the very system is designed to prevent it. Speaking of a preventative system, another Obama eligibility suit filed in Indiana, this from the Associated Press, two Indiana men filed a lawsuit claiming that President-elect Barack Obama is not eligible to serve as president. The suit questions whether Obama meets the constitutional requirement that the president must be a, quote, natural-born citizen. Obama's birth certificate says he was born in Hawaii, but his father was not a U.S. citizen, and some have claimed the document is a fake. The U.S. Supreme Court this month refused without comment to hear a challenge to Obama's citizenship. The Indianapolis Star reports the Indiana suit was filed in Marion Superior Court in Indianapolis by Steve Ankeny from Newcastle and Bill Cruz from Roselawn. It names Governor Mitch Daniels and the Republican and Democratic National Committees as defendants, saying they failed to uphold the Constitution when they certified results of the November election. It asks Judge David Dreyer to throw out the election results. While Obama was chilling in Hawaii, of course, there was the interesting power outage. This from Reuters. Power cut left Obama and family in dark for 12 hours. U.S. President-elect Barack Obama was without electricity for 12 hours at his vacation home on Oahu following a major blackout across Hawaii's most populous island. The outage last Friday night left hundreds of thousands of people, including Obama and his family, in the dark as an electrical storm rolled over Oahu. Power was restored to the residents during the 6 o'clock hour. The Obama family is grateful for the offers of assistance from local officials. The military, as well as, of course, police and Secret Service, were protecting the Obama-siah during when the night the lights went out in Oahu. That's from TimeMagazine.com. That's the source for you for the military protecting Obama in Hawaii. A note, however, from my man James at total411.info, power outage in Hawaii means that Obama Hawaii birth records could be vulnerable. This is a perfect opportunity to switch out the original vital statistics for Barry Obama for newly created forgeries. Now he goes on to actually quote some Hawaii weather patterns and sources, speculating of weather warfare. However, what's not speculation is Kenya gagging Obama's extended family. But we're going to wrap up this little posting on the Obama side with an interesting one. One that is tied very much, I believe, into the citizenship question and the constitutional question. This from the Deutsche Press Agentur from the DPA, Schwarzenegger for U.S. President? Former action hero eyes top job. Former action movie star Arnold Schwarzenegger has not satiated his political ambitions by serving as California governor. The Austrian-born superstar revealed in an interview on 60 Minutes late Sunday night that he would absolutely like to be United States president if the Constitution could be changed to allow foreign-born Americans to run for the White House. Well, you're a man of no small ambition. If the Constitution was changed, would you like to be president, wouldn't you? 60 Minutes journalist Scott Pelley asked. Yeah, absolutely, Schwarzenegger replied. I think that I'm always a person that looks for the next big goal, and I love challenges. I always set goals that are so high that are almost impossible to achieve because then you're always hungry for climbing and climbing because it's always interesting. The climb is always interesting. When you get there, you just have to pick another goal. For now, it would be impossible for him to become president. Schwarzenegger, who was born in Austria and became a U.S. citizen in 1983, is not a natural-born citizen of the U.S. as required by the Constitution. Now, as I've said, if somehow the Obama citizenship question explodes, and maybe it's true, we find out it's a forgery, we will rush headlong to change the Constitution overnight, thereby opening the door for Arnold, son of a Nazi, Schwarzenegger. Of course, quoted as saying this, I thought about the fame, about just being the greatest. I was dreaming about being some dictator of a country or some savior like Jesus. That and much more is, of course, available on ArnoldExposed.com. The last note, for real, on the Obamasiah, on this posting, anyway. Obama predicted to open secret UFO files. And that's from the Examiner, and I'm not going to get into it. There is, however, an interesting comment posted up to this posting where a guy named Ted, and I thank you very much, posts up 7 points about Obama's citizenship and basically says, disprove this. But let's flip the channel to the Microsoft General Electric station and let's listen to Barack H. Obama's Puppet Master, where Zbigniew Brzezinski goes on a TV show with his daughter and a disgraced former congressman and talks some shit. He says, you have such a stunningly superficial knowledge of what went on, it's almost embarrassing to listen to you.
What do we do the next time Israel is attacked? from an outside force. What do we do at that point?
That's the wrong question.
No, that's not the wrong question because we never get the condemnation of Hamas or Hezbollah. It's always after Israel responds to defending itself.
No, it's not. The problem is that this conflict has lasted for years. Now, the United States has been largely passive. So the right question is not what do we do when things break down. The right question is what do we do to avoid a breakdown by being engaged seriously in the peace process. And for the last 8 years, we haven't been. And that's why we have the mess like we have right now in our hands.
You can't blame what is happening in Israel right now on the Bush administration.
Yes, you can.
You can't.
Well,
let's go back to 2000, Dr. Brzezinski. You and I both know Bill Clinton gave Arafat and the Palestinians everything they could have won.
Such a stunningly superficial knowledge of what went on that it's almost embarrassing to listen to you.
Oh, is it?
If you were to look more closely at what happened in the Clinton-Camp David discussions, you would know that what we have just said is absolutely wrong. There were all sorts of provisions and catches to the so-called proposal, and it wasn't rejected. The negotiations went on in Taba, and then there were elections in Israel, and Sharon came in, and everything got aborted. In the last 8 years, we had a policy in which we have proclaimed an interest in peace. Condi Rice has traveled 16 times in 21 months to the region, proclaiming, you must do this, you must do that, but the United States never exerted itself. So the issue that Obama faces, and that's the question that you raised, is, are we going to be sitting there issuing condemnations to this of Hamas or Israel or anybody else, or are we going to be seriously engaged in the peace process? That is the question.
We have another block, and I'm very excited about that because I'm stunningly superficial. Chief, I look forward to you educating me and the rest of America. Hold on. The rest of America and the rest of the foreign policy community who have said time and again Arafat walked away from the best deal he could have got and that the Palestinians never miss an opportunity.
You're repeating slogans. He did not walk away. What he said was, I'm going to take the proposal to all of the Arab capitals and see how they react because the proposals were controversial. And then negotiations went on, even after Christmas, where Clinton and Arafat met. And they were going on in Taba in January, after Clinton was already leaving office. And then the process got aborted. It's helpful to know a little bit about
it. It's very exciting, Chief, that you know things that the rest of the international community doesn't know.
You're going to judge your knowledge by the sort of collective standards of 300 million people. Then don't be surprised that you're embarrassed.
I'm not embarrassed. I read the New York Times and the Washington Post and Foreign Affairs. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to throw those away, and anytime I have a question, I'm going to call you up.
TABA negotiations. Look them up. It will be helpful.
I'll do that, and I'll throw out papers and Foreign Affairs and everything else I read. All right.
Well, don't throw out Foreign Affairs, that wonderful Council on Foreign Relations publication, but Brzezinski is such a sinister, genius, dick bastard. But someone who is intimately connected to Brzezinski and his whole late 70s trilateral National Security Council, left CIA covert operations nationally and internationally. We've mentioned him before, we've mentioned his book before, but now Samuel Clash of Civilizations Huntington has died at the age of 81. This from Reuters. Political scientist Samuel P. Huntington, whose controversial book, The Clash of Civilizations, predicted conflict between the West and the Islamic world, has died at the age of 81. That, of course, coming from a Harvard University press release. Huntington, who taught for 58 years at Harvard before retiring in 2007, died Wednesday at a nursing facility in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, the university again said on its website. In his 1996, The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order, which expanded on his 1993 article in the Council on Foreign Relations Foreign Affairs magazine, Huntington divided the world into rival civilizations based mainly on religious traditions such as Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and Confucianism, and said that competition and conflict among them was inevitable. His focus and his ideology as the sources of conflict in the post-Cold World War triggered broad debate about relations between the Western and Islamic worlds, especially now in the aftermath of September 11th. Despite criticism, his thesis was simplistic, or in the words of Middle East scholar Edward Said, promoting the idea of, quote, West versus the rest. Huntington told Islamica magazine in 2007, quote, my argument remains that cultural identities, antagonisms, and affiliations will not only play a role, but play a major role in relations between states. Huntington's 2004 book, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity, also sparked heated debate by arguing the massive influx of Mexican immigrants to the United States threatened traditional American identity and national unity. People all over the world studied and debated his ideas. Friend and Harvard professor emeritus Henry Rozofsky wrote on the Harvard website, quote, I believe that he was clearly one of the most influential political scientists of the last 50 years. Huntington, who wrote, co-wrote, or edited 17 books, served in the White House in 1977 and 78 under President Jimmy Carter as coordinator for security planning for the National Security Council, thereby infinitely, intimately connected to Zbigniew Brzezinski. Posted up on Google Video, there's an episode of The Charlie Rose Show. If we jump way back to January 30th, 1997, Charlie Rose has on Samuel P. Huntington as he's talking about his then new book, Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order. It's about a half-hour long interview, and actually, if you stick around, there's even interviews with Monty Python's John Cleese and Lauren Bacall. However, here is Samuel Clash of Civilizations Huntington 12 years ago on the Charlie Rose Show.
Everybody says this is a provocative book. I mean, and everybody, whether they agree with everything, always say it's an important contribution to make people think about the way the world is reshaping itself.
So, yeah.
Well, they do. I mean, you know that better than I do. I mean, from Kitchen and other people who think about these issues a lot, and people at the Council of Finance, and a lot of other people in academic environments. They all, many of them, because the thesis is so large, suggest that there are places in which you had to move, you had to make a very tight squeeze to make facts fit your theory. They will say, for example, that there are a number of countries of, let's say, within the Islamic world, which have nothing in common.
Oh, well, sure. I mean,
you can't make an argument that they...
Well, first of all, Islam, as I said, is very divisive.
Right.
There are sub-civilizations within Islam, Arabic, Malay, Turkic, etc. There is a competition going on for leadership in Islam. And this is one of the destabilizing forces at work today. You mentioned earlier that Iran and Saudi Arabia were furnishing arms and support to the Bosnian Muslims. They were competing with each other doing that because they're trying to assert themselves as leaders of Islam. And those two countries, Iran and Saudi Arabia, have furnished support to many other Muslim groups fighting non-Muslims.
You also say it's none of the United States should not get involved in the question of human rights as a part of its trade policy with respect to China. There seems to be the United States ought to, use layman's language, keep its nose out of other nations' business.
Well, I believe that the United States should do what it can to promote our values of human rights and democracy. I think we have to recognize that there are great resistances, obstacles to doing this in many parts of the world, both cultural obstacles and economic obstacles. During the past 20 years, close to 40 countries in the world had shifted from some form of authoritarian rule to some form of democratic rule. Most of those countries are countries which are, have either Western culture or have been heavily influenced by the West. Now, I am not arguing that a country has to be Western to be democratic. India and Japan are two notable examples. That's not the case. All I'm saying is that in some non-Western cultures, and Islam and Confucian culture are the usual examples, there's great resistance to accepting Western values of human rights and democracy because these countries come from totally different cultural traditions.
Are you saying to all Americans and all Western Europeans, wake up, your time is over, the influence of the West is only going to decline in the future?
I think the influence of the West has been declining for some while now during the current century, and it will continue to decline because other nations are modernizing and developing and are acquiring economic wealth and power. And after that, will come military power and political influence. And this is, of course, as I said, most notable with respect to East Asia. Societies. If I may, there was this a wonderful meeting last year of the heads of government from Western Europe and from East Asia in Bangkok,
right.
In which Prime Minister Mahathir of Malaysia got up and told Kohl and Chirac and Major and their colleagues, and I quote him now, "European values are European values. Asian values are universal values." That was turning the tables on the West, which loves its, think of its values
as universal.
As universal, yes.
It's a provocative and interesting book. Samuel Huntington of Harvard University, The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is a book people are talking about, The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order. Samuel P. Huntington.
While not exactly riveting listening, I think it's important nonetheless. That's the now late Samuel P. Huntington, the author of Clash of Civilizations, that basically lays out what we've seen play out in the world. And it's interesting to note, of course, his connections to Brzezinski and the Trilaterals and the National Security Council in the late 70s, as we're seeing a lot of these creepy characters come back again. So that full interview, like I said, is with Charlie Rose. And I believe my man Nathan just mentioned that there's, of course, interviews with Brzezinski as well on Charlie Rose. And I noted, of course, it's great how much the Charlie Rose Show has up on Google Video. They'll try and search for things, and sometimes they'll be the only result. But moving on to geopolitics, this posted up December 31st on MediaMonarchy.com. Geopolitics, troops, bases, pills, and the Greek syndrome. First, from the AFP, at least 20,000 more U.S. troops for the Afghan surge by mid-2009. The United States plans to send between 20,000 and 30,000 additional troops to Afghanistan by summer 2009, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, said Saturday. General David McKiernan, the U.S. commander in Afghanistan, has asked for more than 20,000 extra U.S. troops to counter a rise in insurgent violence, including four combat brigades, an aviation brigade, and other support forces. The buildup would nearly double the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan, raising it from 31,000 troops to over 50,000. Last Friday, a U.S. military official said Defense Secretary Robert Gates had already ordered the deployment of a combat aviation brigade with 2,800 troops to Afghanistan next year. Not missing a beat. More good work. I feel like I say that every time we return to something from Russia today. U.S. to set up bases in Central Asia. The U.S. is planning to set up military bases in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, according to Russia's head of the general staff. He said Washington already has forces in Bulgaria and Romania that can become operational within hours, of course, raising concern in Moscow. This clip doesn't really focus on the U.S. bases part. I edited it down where we're talking to a guy from Iraq, Veterans Against the War, on Russia Today.
The U.S. U.S. is planning to set up bases in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, according to Russia's head of general staff, Nikolai Makarov. Well, according to the general, the U.S. already has forces in Bulgaria and Romania that can become operational within hours, raising much concern in Russia. Speaking at the Academy of Military Science, he also pointed out that the U.S. is encouraging Georgia and Ukraine to join NATO. He also said that anyone hoping for a policy change after Barack Obama takes office is making a dime mistake. Well, to talk more on insurgency in Iraq and possible U.S. policy changes under Barack Obama, we're now joined by Iraqi war veteran and anti-war movement leader Adam Kokesh. Hello to you, Adam. So John Kerry, a prominent anti-war activist, will now head the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. 37 years ago, he testified before the very same committee against the war in Vietnam. How strong are his anti-war feelings today, and how will his leadership influence the committee?
Well, it's funny that you refer to him as an anti-war activist because it's been a long time since that title would apply to him. He was a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and as a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, a group that is in some ways following in their footsteps and in many ways learning from their mistakes and their successes, including many that Kerry himself were responsible for, I'm grateful that he did the work that he did during Vietnam to speak out against the war and empower other veterans to tell the truth about their stories and their experiences in Vietnam. But like I said, it's been a long time since the term anti-war activist would apply to John Kerry, and he's really forgotten any ideals or principles that he may have once had, while fighting against this, the corrupt war in Vietnam. And, we've seen that in his record in the Senate. He's been pretty much an interventionist, the same as most of our leadership. He voted for the war in Iraq before he voted against it, And I don't want to bring up the flip-flopping issue because it's kind of silly to accuse someone of just changing their mind, because I think that's something that we should be encouraging in some ways in our leadership. And it's, a lot of people are hopeful seeing someone like John Kerry, someone who was such an adamant anti-war activist back in the Vietnam era, taking this post. But the country needs a lot more than hope right now. And just like with Obama's foreign policy and his interventionism, I'm not waiting for Kerry as chair of the Foreign Relations Committee to do anything about that. We still have bases in over 130 countries around the world, and have an empire and interventionist foreign policy that generally John Kerry has endorsed. Remember, his appointment is based on seniority, not any kind of merit, but the fact that he's taking it shows that he's going to be willing, I think, to support the Obama party line, which is very dangerous.
Very dangerous indeed. The next interesting story on this geopolitics heading, Little Blue Pills, among the ways CIA wins friends in Afghanistan. This from the BBC as well as the Washington Post. America's CIA has found a novel way to gain information from fickle Afghan warlords, supplying sex-enhancing drug Viagra, a U.S. media report says. The Washington Post said it was one of a number of enticements being used. In one case, a 60-year-old warlord with four wives was given four pills and 4 days later detailed Taliban movements in return for more. Whatever it takes to make friends and influence people, the Post quoted one agent as saying, whether it's building a school or handing out Viagra. Thanks for the boner, CIA. In an amazingly strongly written editorial on B1 of the Washington Post a few days ago, or rather on the 19th of December, the Pentagon is muscling in everywhere. It's time to stop the mission creep. We no longer have a civilian-led government. It's hard for a lifelong Republican and son of a retired Air Force colonel to say this, but the most unnerving legacy of the Bush administration is the encroachment of the Department of Defense into a striking number of aspects of civilian government. Our Constitution is at risk. President-elect Barack Obama's selections of James L. Jones, a retired four-star Marine general, to be his national security advisor, and it appears, and it is, retired Navy Admiral Dennis C. Blair to be his director of national intelligence, present the incoming administration with an important opportunity and major risk. These appointments could pave the way for these respected military officers to reverse the current trend of Pentagon encroachment upon civilian government functions, or they could complete the silent military coup d'etat that has been steadily gaining ground below the radar screen of most Americans in the media. While serving the State Department in several senior capacities over the past 4 years, I witnessed firsthand the quiet, de facto, military takeover of much of the U.S. government. The first assault on civilian government occurred in faraway places, Iraq and Afghanistan, and was, in theory, justified by the exigencies of war. I don't have the name of that writer right clickable, but that's an amazing op-ed that the Washington Post ran. The Pentagon is muscling in everywhere. If we move to Foreign Policy Journal from Jeffrey Hammond, elements of an inside job in Mumbai attacks. Indian police last week arrested Hassan Ali Khan, who was wanted for investigations into money laundering and other illicit activities, and who is also said to have ties to Dawood Ibrahim, the underworld kingpin who evidence indicates was the mastermind behind the terrorist attacks in Mumbai last month. Ibrahim is also alleged to have close ties with both Pakistan's Inter-Service Intelligence, the ISI, and the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. Another character linked to the CIA, whose name is now beginning to figure into the web of connections between the Mumbai attacks, criminal organizations, and intelligence agencies, is none other than Saudi arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi, of Iran-Contra infamy, among many other things. Khashoggi has been implicated in arms deals with drug traffickers and terrorist groups, including within India. Dawood Ibrahim is a known major drug trafficker whom India claims is being protected by Pakistan. As Foreign Policy Journal previously reported, there are also some indications that the CIA has a similar interest in preventing Ibrahim from being handed over to India. Ibrahim is wanted by India for the recent Mumbai attacks, as well as for bombings that occurred there in 1993. The last couple notes and the last couple countries on this geopolitics heading, troops, bases, pills, and the Greek syndrome. It's time to get to the Greek syndrome from theindependent.co.uk. Greek syndrome is catching as youth take to streets. With Europe and the world pitching headlong into deep recession, the quote-unquote Greek syndrome, as one French official coined it, was already being monitored with great care across the European Union. The attempt to politicize and link the disputes across the EU frontiers may prove to be a random act of self-dramatization by an isolated group on the Greek far left. But it does draw attention to the similarities and many differences between the simultaneous outbreaks of unrest in three EU countries. Thousands of young Greeks have been rioting on and off for almost 2 weeks. They are protesting the chaotic and often corrupt social and political system of a country still torn between European modernity and a muddled Balkan past. They can be said in that sense to be truly revolting. The other note of Greek syndrome. We note it around the world. I believe just a couple weeks ago there was some event in Germany involving their secret police. Last year it was Canadian cops in Montebello disguised as protesters or anarchists. And it happens all around, and it happens too often, but fortunately, thanks to things like citizen journalism and the internet, we're able much more quickly to expose agent provocateurs infiltrating groups and causing violence, thereby somehow justifying the crackdown on peaceful protesters. There is a clip, but it is in Greek language. But you can watch it. Greek cops caught on video posing as anarchists. This from Kurt Nemo at truthnews.us. A Greek television show has revealed how Greek police posed as anarchists and destroyed property. Inciting violence and blaming it on legitimate activists is a favorite tactic of the state in order to crack down on protests and dismiss genuine grievances. Now, I have clicked through the clip a little bit, and of course, no one's subtitled it or translated it, unfortunately, yet. I can't tell if they're doing a sort of expose that we discovered this, or if they're showing it more in a ha-ha-ha reality show, like, what happens when we put Greek police officers dressed up as anarchists? Oh, they start fights and break windows. like they're supposed to do, and then their cop buddies pull them out without anyone else noticing, and the rubber bullets and the tear gas flies. Again, whether it was in Montebello, Canada, protesting the Security and Prosperity Partnership, or if it was the provocateurs at the DNC recently, or is Seattle, the Battle of Seattle, provocateurs paid. I believe it was the Seattle Weekly that broke that. You had it in Genoa. You have it everywhere. A couple notes, but I think, although that's probably never true, I think things seem to be okay on this front. But there was another rash of internet cable cutting that happened recently. So there's a couple from Danger Room and Threat Level as well. Undersea cables cut, 14 countries lose the web. That is from Threat Level. Another one asked the question, is the internet going down? Undersea sub cables have just broken. That's from Global Research. We've noted situations like that before, and none too far away, it seems. The speculation being our communications being cut before some kind of operation would take off. But we talked about Greek syndrome. However, before that, we were even talking about the Icelandic syndrome. This from the Associated Press, and again, there is a video, but it is untranslated, so you gotta watch it. I'm not gonna play it for you. Icelandic TV program featuring the Prime Minister forced off the air by protesters. A nationally televised meeting between Iceland's Prime Minister and other political leaders was forced off the air Wednesday night when angry protesters disrupted the broadcast. For more than two decades, the leaders of Iceland's political parties have met every New Year's Eve over champagne and spiced herring to talk about the year ahead on Iceland's Channel 2 television. But this year's show, with Prime Minister Geir Hard, was cut short 45 minutes into the program when a torch-wielding crowd stormed Reykjavik's Hotel Borg in an attempt to get into the studio. Protesters inside and outside the hotel clashed with the police, who fired pepper spray to disperse the 500-strong crowd. Some demonstrators threw water balloons, while others tossed firecrackers. At one point, the broadcaster's television cables caught fire, interrupting the live broadcast. The program cut to commercial, followed by an announcement that Channel 2's equipment had been damaged and the show would be suspended. Outside the hotel, a policeman hit on the head with a brick had to be hospitalized. Three other protesters were arrested. You must see that video. I suppose I could have cut out a little bit of the raging and screaming and Icelandic chaos, but I won't. And as we wind down this episode 105, I'm going to have to skip over some of the Okana crash notes and some of the 9/11 updates and just squeeze in one more story here on the home front. This from the Albany Democrat Herald out of Oregon. Organized taxing vehicles per mile by satellite. A year ago, ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation, announced it had demonstrated that a new way to pay for roads via a mileage tax and satellite technology could work. Now, Governor Ted Kulongoski says he'd like the legislature to take the next step. As part of a transportation-related bill he has filed for the 2009 legislative session, the governor says he plans to recommend, quote, a path to transition away from the gas tax as the central funding source for transportation, end quote. What that means is explained on the governor's website, quote, with a link for you, as Oregonians drive less and demand more fuel-efficient vehicles, it is increasingly important that the state find a new way other than the gas tax to finance our transportation system. According to the policies he has outlined, Kulongoski proposes to continue the work of the special task force that came up with and tested the idea of a mileage tax to replace the gas tax. The governor wants the task force, quote, to partner with auto manufacturers to refine technology that would enable Oregonians to pay for the transportation system based on how many miles they drive. The online outline adds, the governor is committed to ensuring that rural Oregon is not adversely affected and that privacy concerns are addressed. When the task force study and tests were in the news in 2006 and 2007, critics worried that the technology could be used to track where vehicles go, not just how far they travel, and that this information would somehow be stored by the government. in more than one interview with the Democrat Herald and others, James Whitty, W-H-I-T-T-Y, James Whitty, the ODOT official in charge of the project, tried to assure the public that tracking people's travels was not in the plans. They always say that, don't they? It's always something reasonable. It always starts out for the children, or for Mother Earth, perhaps in this case. And did you note it basically said, we don't want to phase out this other tax. We just want to phase this one in alongside it. We want to take some of the burden off of the gas tax and put it on a satellite GPS-based tracking grid. And we can tax you that way. Okay, one more. It's still about surveillance. It's still about the state. This from Danger Room. $2 million Tex-Mex surveillance system nets 500 pounds of pot. A new $2 million citizen surveillance system installed along the Tex-Mex border has yielded just one crime bust after about 6 weeks in operation. Three suspects who were allegedly caught hauling 540 pounds of marijuana over the border after someone spotted them online, according to the Houston Chronicle. The expensive system of 13 closed-circuit cameras placed along the Rio Grande, which is billed as a virtual stakeout for virtual deputies, involves images from the cameras that are streamed online. Members of the public are now invited to serve as virtual deputies by watching the images and reporting any suspicious activity they see. Although authorities wouldn't provide any details about the arrest, saying they didn't want to give information that would reveal the location of the surveillance camera that spotted the suspects, it's presumed that the arrest was the result of a citizen report. Snitch Nation. So I went to blueservo.net and signed up, and I actually tried to get a screen grab from one of the cameras to post up with the story instead of just the little stock AP photo I posted up. But it must have been nighttime because I couldn't see anything but maybe some dark trees and lots of grainy digital static. But you should go check it out. You should sign up and be a virtual deputy. Because as the economy collapses, there'll only be service jobs and probably jobs in the new civilian national security force. There's so much more left that I'm not going to have time to get into on this episode, so you can keep an ear peeled for it on the upcoming B-side of episode 105, of course, where we'll get into the 9/11 myths. We've got Olbermann. We've got toxic Tennessee sludge dump. Disgusting disaster. More from Collateral News and Clyde Lewis and tons more. However, let's do two things before we wrap it up very quickly. And click over to the breaking news at the moment from BBC. Gaza facing critical emergency. The UN has warned that Palestinians in Gaza are facing a serious health and food crisis as Israeli airstrikes continued for a seventh day. Russia Today has first foreigners evacuated from Gaza, and Reuters have Israel may keep options open on Gaza ceasefire. If we hit CNN International, Muslim family removed from plane remains at odds with airline. A day after a Muslim family was removed from a flight at Reagan National Airport near Washington, officials of AirTran Airways and the family stood their ground Friday, each accusing the other of misconduct. Muslim family booted off U.S. airline after comments. And of course, we'll note again for you, as we just read BBC reporting Gaza facing critical emergency, you will note that our two misleaders say nothing. Some of the creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past, I suppose this may be almost a two-week list, although it's not 2 weeks long exactly. We had the IRS out of D.C., Googled Nazi POW camps in America, and there were, they're in Virginia. GeneticAlliance.org out of Washington, D.C., they're reading about Enviro Health, death maps, and data banks. Of course, the Fort Belvoir Army Googled PSYOP Heidelberg, interestingly enough. The Victory Fund out of Washington, D.C. studied headbanging can cause traumatic brain injury, and we went over that in the B-side of 104 the other day. Of course, the Drug Enforcement Administration, J.P. Morgan and Chase were reading about Project Bluebeam. The DOD Network Information Center, they were also reading about headbanging to heavy metal music causing traumatic brain injury, while, of course, they use banging heavy metal, drowning pool, Nine Inch Nails stuff to torture people. So maybe they're learning a little more. Oh, we need to up the BPMs. The U.S. Department of State, reading about the Department of Justice stalling an anthrax investigation. Somebody at NYU Googled Delta Airlines backseat prisoner transport. Someone at the New Jersey State Library Googled media monarchy. Bain and Company out of Boston, Massachusetts Googled holographic projector programmed to call upon death. I have no idea what that means, and it scares the hell out of me. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services out of Upper Marlboro, Maryland. They were reading about Police State International, DHS, Triple W, Seaburn, and the breakup of U.S. Again, Fort Benning out of Georgia. They hit me up for my link on sourcewatch.org reading about Blackwater Worldwide. The New Jersey State Department of Treasury hit me up from Blacklisted News. The Marquette Bank out of Chicago, Illinois. Someone there Googled Illuminati Secrets TV Box Black Pope. Again, the DOD Network Information Center out of Alexandria, interestingly enough, Googled Carlyle Group HARP. Carlyle Group, of course, being Poppy Bush's international coterie, and HARP, of course, being the High Active Auroral Research Project and perhaps weather weapon in Alaska. Saudi Arabian Oil Company, reading about NORAD releasing a motherload of 9/11 tapes back on the anniversary of 9/11 in 2007. And finally, the Army Recreation Machine in West Point, New York. They, of course, were reading and watching and listening to Brzezinski tell Joe Scarborough that he's stunningly superficial and embarrassing to listen to. And that's going to do it. And I hope I'm not stunningly superficial and embarrassing to listen to. I try and give you all the best in news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups, and will continue to do it well into 2009 and beyond. My friends, this has been episode 105 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. Like my man, Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get the same.